Good afternoon and welcome to Health Styles. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. You can follow us online at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. Recent events surrounding the deaths of Michael Brown, Eric Garner, and other African Americans are heightening our nation's awareness of the pervasiveness of the stress that all people of color in the United States experience in their daily lives simply because of their race or ethnicity. My colleague and co-producer, Dr. Kenya Beard, has been bringing to Health Styles ongoing discussions of health disparities. Today, she and I talk with Dr. Willie Tolliver, professor at the Hunter College School of Social Work, about the link between racism and stress and its impact on the health of African Americans. But first, we're going to revisit an issue that I just covered at the end of 2014 on Vermont's proposed single-payer system that was to launch in 2017. For those of us who embrace a single-payer system, we've been quite interested in this state experiment, hoping that it could be a model for other states, including New York, and eventually spread throughout the nation, much as the Canadian health system developed. On that program, I interviewed Dr. Betty Ramber, a registered nurse and professor of nursing and health policy at the University of Vermont. She's one of five members of Vermont's Green Mountain Care Board that has had oversight of the single-payer plan in Vermont. Today, I welcome her back to talk about the shock that we all got when the re-elected governor, Peter Shumlin, scrapped the plan in mid-December. Betty, welcome back to Health Styles.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So let's remind listeners of how a plan for Vermont to develop a single-payer system evolved. How did that come about?
Sure. So the state of Vermont passed groundbreaking legislation in Act 48, and that happened a few years ago in 2011. And as part of that, there were multiple aspects of reform. One was a single payer, and the other pieces of it relate to payment and delivery reform. So an effort to unlink insurance status from employment, but also a very strong cost containment piece, moving away from fee-for-service. And the manner in which the legislation was set up is that the governor was to propose the funding for the single payer. Obviously, the legislature would have to approve the mechanism. And then the Green Mountain Care Board served in a quasi-judicial role to assure that it was sustainable, that it had certain kinds of pieces in place. So we served as sort of a judge in the end, if you will. So the governor has decided that the state could not afford to move ahead at this time, but we're continuing to move ahead with the other pieces, such as cost containment efforts, testing out different kinds of delivery models that move away from fee-for-service.
So you serve on the Green Mountain Care Board that's been overseeing this work. Did the board know that the governor was going to scrap the plan?
I certainly did know, and we have sort of a unique feature here, and I think it's a very important one. We are a completely independent body, so the five of us do not report to the chair of the board. We do not report to the governor. We are an independent body with accountability to the people of the state, and so certainly we knew that the financing plan had been delayed initially. It was planned to be presented basically a year ago. And we knew, of course, that different pieces were being modeled. But no, I certainly did not.
So how does the governor have the authority to decide that a piece of legislation that was passed by a part of a piece of legislation that was passed by the legislature and that he signed into law will no longer move forward?
Well, I'm not an attorney who can probably answer that kind of question, but I think that, you know, it would be fair to say that in putting together the model, the statute did require that the benefits package be at least an 80% actuarial value, and that means that people would pay no more than 20% of healthcare costs on average, out of pocket with co-pays and deductibles and that type of thing. And many people in the state have a much more rich plan than that. And so the plan that was modeled...
Much more rich, meaning they pay less than that.
They pay less. Thank you. Yes, they pay less. And so the plan that was modeled was at a higher actuarial value. Now, the governor, Thursday,
That's Thursday, January, 15th?
15th, correct. Uh-huh. January 15th, the governor will be having his formal presentation of the budget, and we will hear more about his plans for health care at that time. So it's all relatively new, and it's new to many of us here in the state, and we're all, of course, taking it in. However, I have always maintained that the payment reform piece is absolutely critical. Get the waste out of the system, get the overtreatment out of the system, and hopefully we can continue on that pathway to reduce the cost.
So there were widely varying estimates of what the plan would cost. But before we get into that, I want to just refresh listeners with who would fall under the single payer plan if it had moved forward.
Right, right.
There are
a lot of groups
exempt.
Right. So certainly Medicare was remaining in place. Medicare is obviously a federal program that individuals 65 and above enjoy for the most part. And Medicaid also was going to remain in place. At least that was what we believed would happen. Of course, we didn't see the plan. And there's also businesses that, they're so-called ERISA businesses that the state cannot regulate because of an overriding federal law. And earlier suggestions were that those individuals would also still pay taxes and have payroll tax, but those in Medicaid care would not. So there was a lot of details to work out because we have these strong federal programs in place and federal laws. And we would have also needed a federal waiver out of the Affordable Care Act. So it often sounds like a very simple thing, but there's actually a lot of moving parts that would have needed to be put in place.
So there were these widely varying estimates of what it was going to cost. How confident are you in the estimates that suggested it was going to cost too much?
Well, we certainly had the responsibility to do an independent review of the cost because right now healthcare is roughly 20% of the gross state product. So when you think about moving something around that has, you know, that much part of the economy, it's very important that your numbers are as right as possible. And so the governor's office had a group working on it. I believe the legislature was also going to run their own numbers, and then we would have done that as well. And so we would have been very certain that we would have enough money in the coffers to do what we were intending to do. I think it's also important for people to remember we're all paying for health care anyway. We're just paying for it in different kinds of ways, through taxes, through employer premiums, employer-based health insurance, out of pocket. But the on-ramp for this transition felt, according to the governor, more than he felt that was appropriate for the state at this time.
To what extent was the business community and insurers, private insurers, to what extent were they effective in pressuring a slowdown or stopping the single payer?
I can't really attest. I really can't. I don't have a strong sense of that. Vermont is a very progressive state, and there's lots of business people that are very pro-single payer because they see the impact of healthcare costs on their businesses, et cetera. But like any social change, there's a range of opinions. And the governor has been supportive of single payer for a very, very long time. So my sense is that it was the numbers that were daunting. Vermont has been having a bit of an economic downturn and had a budget shortfall this year as well outside of this issue. So there's lots of, you know, economic factors that played into his decision, I'm sure.
And do you have a lot of private insurers, a lot of insurance companies, health insurance companies in the state?
We do not. We do not have a lot of health insurance companies in the state. If you think about our roughly 650,000 people, that's, you know, the size of a mid-sized community. And so there are a lot of insureds who frankly haven't been particularly interested in being in the state of Vermont.
So when this decision was announced, how did Vermonters react?
Well, there was an enormous range of responses. A coalition that's called Healthcare is a Human Right protested, had rallying on the Capitol grounds, went to the State House. They also came to our Green Mountain Care Board meeting to protest, even though we have no authority over the governor's decision. You know, decision making, that's up to the governor. So there was, you know, groups that are very, very upset, others that are very relieved, according to what I read in here, and still others that feel very strongly that not now doesn't mean never. And so clearly we'll know a bit more as the legislative session goes on. Act 48 remains in place, and we're continuing to do a lot with different payment models like bundled payments, global budgets, et cetera. So we have a lot of work that we're doing on the cost side. And what people are typically complaining about healthcare is cost and access. And so that still is ongoing and is within the authority that we have here at the Green Mountain Care Board.
And just to help our listeners, explain how bundled payments and global payments can help cost and access.
Sure. So healthcare has traditionally been paid for on a fee-for-service basis. And you can think of this sort of in the construction world as like time and materials. The more you do, the more you get paid. The more material you use, the more you get paid. And providers' accountability horizon, and I say this as a nurse, has been relatively short. So we would see the patient in front of us, and however it would turn out, we would certainly give care, good care right in front of them, but let's say they got a medication prescribed for high blood pressure. We weren't really held accountable for whether or not they took it, whether or not the blood pressure went down, et cetera. And the more the patient visited us, the more we would be paid. So that creates a lot of fragmentation of care, a lack of care coordination, particularly in an aging society when so much of what we need is coordination of care of chronic conditions. So, for example, in a bundled payment, instead of all these things being broken out and charged for separately, there is a payment for the whole set of services. And so in that kind of model, you really have, for example, using the example of the individual with high blood pressure, really try to get at their lifestyle issues, really try to keep them out of the emergency room and keep things from, you know, accelerating. Trying to understand if they didn't get the prescription filled, why didn't they get the prescription filled? Maybe they can't afford it. Maybe they can't get to the pharmacy. So it really puts the emphasis more on the person and a person-centered responsibility. There's also much more incentive to use the least intensive appropriate level of care. So, for example, rather than very quickly thinking about back surgery, there's much more incentive to initially think about physical therapy or some of those kinds of things. So it actually puts sort of the onus for cost and quality in partnership among the providers and the patient.
So you made a statement earlier that if you can bring down healthcare costs, it might enable the state to revisit the single-payer option.
Right.
So what are you doing other than, even with bundled payments and global payments, what are you doing to try to bring down those costs and improve efficiencies in Vermont?
Right. Well, a couple of additional things that are being considered. We have an enormous cost shift in the state, and a cost shift basically means when one payer underpays, those costs are shifted to private commercial insurance, which makes insurance even more expensive. Mm. And so we have initiatives in place to address the cost shift as one piece.
Can you give us an example of that?
Sure. So let's say, I mean, in healthcare, costs and charges are not the same. Mm-hmm. So if you think of Medicare reimburses theoretically at cost, which is roughly 60% of charges, and Medicaid at less than cost, typically, in the state. So those costs are actually borne by those with commercial insurance, employer-based insurance. And they see that in their premium, but they don't understand that roughly perhaps 50 to 20% of that premium is to cover the cost shift. Economists call that a hidden tax. And so an employed Vermonter is paying in to Medicare, which they hope to use someday. They're paying in at some level to Medicaid through federal taxes and state taxes. They're receiving their employer-based insurance as a reduction in real wages. And then they're also subsidizing the underpayment of Medicare and Medicaid through this cost shift. So this is a very sort of odd and paradoxical way to fund healthcare. And sometimes when I'm sharing about the cost shift with my students, they'll say, "Dr. Amber, it can't be that way. That doesn't make any sense." But in that is, in fact, how healthcare has been funded. So this sort of hidden tax piece with this cost shift is substantial, because when employer-based insurance gets more and more expensive, people may not be able to afford it, or they get a plan that has more cost sharing, higher co-pays and deductibles, and that creates other kinds of challenges. So that's one very important piece that we are working on.
But how can you address that, given that it's also involves these federal programs or federal-state programs?
Right. Great question. And our intention is to put together a request for a waiver, which would have to be granted from CMS. And
the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid.
Yes,
services.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. And we will put together a proposal of what we think makes sense for the state of Vermont, but also put perhaps as a testing ground for other states. And then they'll say yes or no. And so that's one very important piece, because the bottom line is healthcare is simply too expensive. And when we look at the outcomes of the United States, we lag far behind other developed nations. Mm-hmm. And so the cost piece and the quality piece is central to the work we do, regardless of whether or not we're moving ahead with the single payer right now.
Let me just remind listeners that you're listening to Health Styles. I'm Diana Mason, and I'm talking with Dr. Betty Ramber, a registered nurse and professor of nursing and health policy at the University of Vermont. She also is one of five members of Vermont's Green Mountain Care Board that has had oversight over the single payer plan in Vermont and healthcare. And it's your board is also over the whole reform effort under Act 48 that established the single payer option, or not?
Well, it's interesting how it's been in the state. The exchange is actually under the Vermont Department of Health Access, the Health Insurance Exchange. That is in the same branch of government that oversees Medicaid. And then the governor's office was responsible for developing the financing plan for the single payer. But within our board, we are responsible for oversight of payment reform initiatives. We're responsible for hospital budgets. We are responsible for, we have insurance rate under our authority. We're responsible for certificate of need. So we actually have quite broad regulatory authority as well. Mm-hmm.
So let me go back to then what you're trying to do in terms of promoting more efficiencies and reducing healthcare costs. When you talked about going to CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, for a waiver, what would that waiver propose doing?
Well, right now we are in the process of developing that, so I'll have to say stay tuned, but we are actually now in the process of really thinking through what something like that would look like, what it would look like, what would make sense, how do we address it. So that's in process, very early in process.
And what else do you look to? Where else do you see there are opportunities to reduce healthcare costs while improving the quality of care and the health of the population of Vermont?
Right. One of the things that we're very focused on as a state is really strengthening our primary care network. And we have areas that are rural, not as rural as some parts of the country, but certainly rural areas. But we also have, you know, all kinds of pockets of poor access or not sufficient access to primary care. And we know from nations that have a high emphasis on primary care, they have better outcomes and lower costs. So certainly enhancing primary care. And we have in the state, of course, this is separate from the Green Mountain Care Board, but one, we have our first nurse practitioner-run clinic, our first nurse-run clinic that is in a part of town that otherwise would be underserved and a part of our major city, Burlington. So we have different kinds of things going on. We have accountable care organizations that have developed that are very focused on high-quality care, reducing cost. We're trying to better integrate services so people don't fall through the cracks. So those are some of the kind of payment reform initiatives that are happening. The other thing that I personally feel very, very strongly about is the issue of over-treatment. Mm-hmm. Choose Wisely initiative that has started, that is really the list of things patients should and physicians and nurses and others should really question if they should be done. That's an important initiative. Shared decision-making is part of the Affordable Care Act, really laying out the option so that decisions can be made that best match the patient's values and interests when there's a choice and a range of treatment options. So some of those things are really at the working surface of healthcare, and that's where a big difference can be made.
So Betty, what do you believe could be done to move forward with more shared decision making then? If this is seen as a way to improve the health of the population and reduce costs, how do you see how can your board foster that?
Right, that's a great question. I think one of the things we've been working hard on doing is partnering with the providers across the state. But secondly, a lot of the momentum in healthcare is the fee-for-service momentum. It's much easier to see a patient and give them a prescription and send them on their way than to really sit down and talk about the options. And so part of at least my hope with payment reform is that you're really moving to a very different kind of model that creates an opportunity for patient-provider relationships. We have a lot of person-centered health homes, often called patient-centered medical homes, but I prefer the other term, that really are about creating a network of support for individuals and families. And in some situations, the most important person for a most important provider for a patient might be the nutritionist or the physical therapist. And certainly there's a role for more intense medical care or surgical care. But much of what we often need is other kinds of things, support for smoking cessation, et cetera. So we have patient-centered medical homes, which have been quite successful in our state. We have accountable care organizations that are relatively new and moving along. And then we have these other more aggressive movements away from fee-for-service that are being tested, like bundled payments and global budgets.
So, forecast for me. If some of these efforts are successful, do you see single payer as being back on the table, and how do you see that evolving? Will it require bringing more of the population into the coverage under a single payer option?
Well, the law, Act 48, still is in place, and so we will continue to do the cost containment initiatives. And as with anything else, when you're trying something new, some of it will work well and some of it won't, and some will work in some populations and some won't. So one wonderful thing about the state of Vermont is it's actually small enough that you have some hope of evaluating what worked well and what didn't in a way that's much more difficult in a larger state just because there's so many additional variables. And I think we will have a very interesting legislative session because, you know, the legislature are the ones who initially passed Act 48, and I don't know what the next steps will be for them. There are many people who remain very, very, very committed to single payer, and they understand that it may not be able to be the whole piece all at once, et cetera, but there's still a lot of will in the state to do this.
So if people want to follow this issue and how Vermont proceeds, is there a good website that you would refer people to?
Sure. There's a couple. One, at the governor's state, vermont.gov, there is a health reform link. And then the Green Mountain Care Board is also has a link that is separate that really details really everything that we're doing, because we are, everything we do is in the public. And so all of our minutes, all of our meetings, the meetings are taped, and all of our documents are available at the Green Mountain Care Board website.
And just one final question. You shared with me a link of a video where people were storming a Green Mountain Care Board meeting. What was the purpose of that demonstration? Is there a belief that the board has authority over single payer moving forward?
Well, I think it's fair to say that for the public, this can be very confusing. Who's doing what?
Yeah.
And so I believe that, I would assume that that's why they came to the board. And in that storming of our meeting, I made the motion to suspend our typical agenda and put that aside so that each person could speak.
Yes.
And so everyone had a chance to speak, and there's always a chance to speak at our meetings. And the stories are heartbreaking of people not being able to afford coverage. And, you know, we hear that and feel that very, very deeply, and we're very committed to focusing on cost containment and enhancing access and improving quality, regardless of what happens with the financing mechanisms.
How long is your term on the board?
Interestingly, my term is actually over in August of 2015.
Oh. Renewable?
Yes, renewable. The first members on the board had staggered terms, mm-hmm. and I filled when the first chair left, I filled the term of another board member.
Well, I want to thank you for the conversation today. This is an important issue, and WBAI listeners are real, by and large, very much advocates for a single-payer system. There is our Assemblyman Chair of the Assembly Health Committee, Richard Gottfried, continues to sponsor legislation in the state for a single-payer option, but I think it's going to take, not a single-payer option, a single-payer plan, and I think it's going to take probably evidence from another state, like Vermont, a smaller state that's more manageable, and as you said, where you can really do a good evaluation of the impact, for states such as New York to really go in that direction and get the support for it. So this is enormously important work, and I thank you for your service.
Thank you. Yes, stay tuned to Vermont. We'll
see
what happens next.
Yeah, so thank you. I've been talking to Dr. Betty Ramber, a registered nurse and professor of nursing and health policy at the University of Vermont. She's one of five members of Vermont's Green Mountain Care Board that has had oversight of the single-payer plan and health care reform in Vermont. You're listening to Health Styles. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. You can follow us online at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM New York. For this segment of Health Styles, I'm joined by co-producer and nurse extraordinaire, Dr. Kenya Beard. Hi, Kenya. How are you?
I'm well.
Good.
It's always great to be back on the air with you, Diana.
Well,
we're going to take a closer look at health disparities.
Great.
And discuss innovative ways to improve the health of our society. A few weeks ago, last month, we aired a segment that addressed high blood pressure, also known as hypertension. And we focused on high blood pressure not just because it's the silent killer affecting one out of three Americans, but because when it comes to health disparities, we see the alarmingly disproportionate effect that high blood pressure has on blacks. For instance, blacks have a higher incidence of high blood pressure, and it affects them at a younger age. They have a higher prevalence, where we see that close to 40% of black adults have high blood pressure. And lastly, the mortality rate is much higher, and high blood pressure kills. So on the last segment with Dr. Carla Booten Foster from Weill Cornell, she had joined us to discuss her research around high blood pressure in the Harlem community. And she raised a critical concern. Stress has an important fact, plays an important factor in high blood pressure. So typically when we discuss risk reduction strategies or the management of high blood pressure, we sort of emphasize lifestyle modification. We talk about the importance of a healthy diet, exercise, and rest. But Carla alluded to a critical concern that is sometimes overlooked because it's not always easily recognized, and that's the effect that stress has on blood pressure. We know that stress definitely has a physiological effect on our body because it causes our blood vessels to constrict, and that raises our blood pressure, but it is believed to have a short-term effect on the body as well. Now, more evidence is coming into play, and it's suggesting that chronic stress could be just as significant as high cholesterol or have similar effects to smoking. But what's also disconcerting is that chronic stress could play a key part in why we continue to see disparities in health and health outcomes. So what exactly does stress look like in the Black community? Joining us today to respond to this question is Dr. Willie Tolliver. He's been a social worker since 1976 and is currently on the faculty of the Silberman School of Social Work at Hunter College and the Social Welfare Doctoral Program at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Willie has served on the faculties of Florida A&M University Social Welfare Department and the Boston University School of Social Work. His research has focused on human diversity and cultural competence and anti-oppressive and restorative practice, and we are delighted to have him on the show today. So, Dr. Tolliver, welcome to Health Styles.
Thank you so much, Kenya. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So I'm interested in hearing what you have to say about what chronic stress looks like in the Black community.
Okay. It looks like, no surprise, racism. Social injustice in the African-American community is generational. It has been experienced by family members one generation after another. People, unless they are have a way, an analysis to talk about these issues, then the way they talk about them are fall on a range from it's just a man with his foot on my neck to something more sophisticated. And the inability to talk and to analyze these issues in a way that focuses people on what they can do about these problems causes this trauma to get suppressed. And it goes into family members, younger family members who really don't know what's going on. They just know that there's a great deal of tension at certain times in the house. Maybe it's around being able to pay rent or pay mortgage, or someone has lost a job, or more recently we see high incarceration rates, so people disappear and they go off to prison or they go off to jail, and there really isn't a ritual for family members to grieve the loss of this person who has psychologically and emotionally disappeared. So these stressors are omnipresent. People don't get away from them, unlike the military veteran who comes home from the military theater of war and experiences post-traumatic stress disorder. These are folks who are living in a chronic situation of stress and trauma.
So this is so timely, given what's been going on both in New York and in Ferguson, Missouri, and elsewhere. It really is quite timely.
Yes, it is, Diana. It is, and it's especially in my profession, it's almost unforgivable for me that clinical practitioners have not made this association of trauma and the impact of trauma. I mean, we know what that does to people. We know that it causes people to live in a survival mode. So much of what we do in terms of psychotherapy requires a person to be in higher brain functioning. It's very difficult to do talk therapy, which is higher brain functioning, when you're in survival mode. Mm. And so many of the populations we deal with here in New York City or across the country living in urban centers are in this space where they are constantly expecting the shoe to fall or some horror to occur.
So, Willie, you said that some clinicians are not addressing this issue. Why do you think that is?
I don't think people have really made the connection of trauma and historical trauma. I don't think that's understood. I mean, I didn't start seeing this in the literature myself until there was a woman at Harvard, Bajan, I think is her name, in psychology, who started working in indigenous communities here in North America, people who are Native Americans, and she saw, for example, all of the things that you talked about in your setup, Kenya. She saw high blood pressure. She saw high rates of alcoholism, suicide, depression. She saw children being abused physically, emotionally, sexually. She also saw high rates of domestic violence, intimate partner violence. And rather than blaming the people for this, she looked to see structurally what had occurred. And, of course, not everyone knows this history, but the history of the way Native people were treated in this country is appalling. And so what she did, instead of blaming these people for the physical and medical conditions that she found them in, she worked with them to reconnect to their ritual ways of healing to heal the trauma. Many of the folks, in fact, there's a wonderful film that we use here at the school about the Inupiat people in Alaska. And many of the folks, these Inupiat people made the film themselves, a documentary, as a way of apologizing to their children for not teaching them the language and not teaching them the rituals and traditions of their people. Mm. And what the folks in the film talk about is how they were removed from their parents and sent to boarding schools, to live in boarding schools, and how traumatic that was for them. One guy talks about how they cried in as if they were an orchestra. It sounded like an orchestra playing with all of these children crying. And clearly this was social policy embraced by the United States of America, implemented to drive out the savage in Native American people, to make them assimilate.
Yeah,
how do we move forward, Willie? How do we get past the historical trauma and allow individuals and groups to heal? Because it sounds like, you know, the threat of discrimination definitely creates a state of hypervigilance.
Absolutely.
And
if
that's the case, then how do we truly achieve a state of relaxation? How do we move forward?
I don't know that we will achieve a state of relaxation. I love to read Du Bois. I enjoy going back reading the folks who came a long time before us and to learn from them how they took on living in a world that was really not nice to them. And nice is putting it, very... lovingly, but what I can see in their writing and in their actions is that African Americans have done better in this country when African Americans actually named what their concerns were and addressed those concerns through their own actions. Of course, they had to form alliances with other people to get things accomplished, and for example, at Florida A&M University, where I taught and also was an undergraduate student, during the times of segregation in Florida, African American people in the state of Florida raised money to build a hospital at Florida A&M University so that their nursing students could learn how to become nurses. Mm-hmm. The segregated hospitals would not permit nursing students to come in and do internships, right? So I think that there will always be struggle. At least this is what Derek Bell says, and he's someone I have great respect for as well. You know, he was at Harvard, teaching in the law school, left there because the administrator said they could not find a woman to tenure in the law school, so he gave up his tenure position and came to NYU. He's now deceased. But one of the things that he says that I take to heart is that we must recognize that these struggles will be with us and struggle anyway. Mm. We must do the work. And I think what I see that has promise, there's one program out in Santa Ana, California. It's called Latino Health Access, founded by a woman from South America who is a public health physician. And she went into Santa Ana, saw that the 70% Spanish-speaking community had all of the things that you talked about, diabetes, the things that I talked about, intimate partner violence, alcoholism. She chose diabetes as her point of entry. She's mm-hmm. now working with people. They have what she works with people who are living with diabetes, teaches them how to live with diabetes and to live in a way that has a quality of life that they can enjoy. And then these promotories, as they're called, these promoters, go out and find other people who are living with diabetes in the community, work with them, help them to learn about diet, how to prepare healthy foods. When I went out to visit in 2010, there were young people now in elementary schools and in middle schools who are weighing themselves, paying attention to what they eat. And all of this, I mean, you have 15-year-old kids writing articles to other adolescents to help them understand how we must take responsibility for our health care and take care of ourselves.
Okay. So what I'm hearing is that we really can no longer just sit by and allow people to suppress their trauma, and that we really need to provide ways for communities to effectively express their reality.
Absolutely.
We're listening to Health Styles on WBAI with Dr. Diana Mason and Dr. Kenya Beard. We have Dr. Willie Tolliver from the Silberman School of Social Work at Hunter College and the Social Welfare Doctoral Program at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York joining us today. We have been discussing the effect that chronic stress has on high blood pressure, and Willie has been giving us a visual of what chronic stress looks like in the Black community, both today and historically. So, Willie, do you see the stress-related ramifications that stem from the Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Eric Gardner as being different from the day-to-day stressors that some communities face today?
I think that the stressors associated with Mike Brown, Trayvon Martin, It's strange. In many ways, you know, I work with young people here at the school. One young man who he's actually a man of African descent. He came to this country as a child, but he's not African American. He's a person from the continent, and he shared with me that he had been stopped 30 times by police officers.
Wow.
And I have talked to other students of color here in our school, and they report similar things. And then when we ask them, so what is that like for you? Unsurprisingly, their response is, it's normal. Mm. It's normal. It's what we expect. Mm. It's what we've learned to expect. It's what we live with. Well, of course, this is not normal. Mm. And it's chilling to think that our children are growing up here in New York City. You know, we had a man come in for an interview, for a position, and he was doing very interesting research, and it was about working with young people using technology and media like text and so forth to get them to come for their therapy sessions. And I asked him what he thought about what was happening with children here in New York City, Black and brown children with stop and frisk. And his response was, well, you know, it's bad. It should not be happening. And it is our reality. Well, that to me is problematic. I think that as practitioners and as scholars and researchers, we too have accepted this kind of behavior or this kind of reality as the way things are, and that's just the way it is. When in fact, these things are extremely harmful. It causes great harm to young people because now what are those young men going to do who are now going to become fathers? Those young women, I mean, I have women in class who tell me now that we're teaching the anti-oppression content that we are, through this content, awakening areas that they have long suppressed. Mm. And the way they get through their lives is to keep that stuff buried deeply. Mm. So here we have people who are going to work with other human beings being inauthentic in who they are. Because to be fully who they are is to place them at risk.
So it sounds like a double-edged sword. You know, what are those untoward effects of the suppressing or the burying racism? If you acknowledge it, you
yes.
have to deal with the pain. If you suppress it, it comes out in other ways, perhaps
right.
through blood
yes,
pressure.
Yes.
And it perpetuates healthcare disparities. Before
yes.
we wrap up, I want to emphasize that hypertension kills. About 1,000 deaths per day are attributed to high blood pressure. It robs some people of their eyesight. It contributes to the alarmingly high rate of individuals who currently receive dialysis, and African Americans make up a large proportion of the patients on dialysis. High blood pressure is a health condition that affects 1 out of 3 Americans and disproportionately affects blacks. If you or someone you know has high blood pressure, consider how chronic stress could be impacting your ability to live a healthier life and what actions need to be taken to eliminate or manage chronic stress. Diana, is there anything else you want
to
share?
Yeah, we've got about 5 minutes left, actually, and I actually wanted to go back to that point that you just raised as well as add on to that, the idea of the double-edged sword, and I'm interested, Willie, in your thoughts about the issue of if you suppress, you're holding it in, it can blow up later, play out later. If you don't suppress it, you know, it's with you always. It's way too present and painful sometimes. What's okay. your sense about that and what you do with that?
Where I am today on this, and I have arrived at this place after years of looking and understanding, because, again, what we're talking about is, for me, internalized racism, mm-hmm. which would have me say to myself, somehow I am responsible for mm-hmm. the fact that I am treated so badly in this country. Yesterday I was having a conversation with my cousin who is going to introduce me when I speak in my hometown of Apalachicola, Florida, for the 28th annual celebration of MLK. And he and I are the same age. We went through school together. And he was saying to me, you know, Willie, probably the best thing we can do for our children right now is to teach them that when they are stopped by police, they must be very cautious and very careful, that they have to keep their hands where the police can see them, that they must not get angry, that they must maintain a sense of composure and stay very calm. And I listened to that, and, you know, the week of December 16th, we had a protest here on our campus, and I listened to about 300 students in 2 different days talking about their upset around the Eric Garner and Mike Brown situations. And what they essentially said to me as one of these folks from the 60s is, you guys were accommodationists mm. in the way you dealt with these issues. And
wow.
your accommodating did not prepare this place for us to show up as full human beings. Mm. And if we're going to die anyway from this stuff, we may as well die struggling.
Hmm.
So I think that I hope it's not as bad as that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the fact that we older heads are still around, we must contribute something here. And I think the contribution that we can make is to create opportunities for people to heal from these traumas.
That is possible.
People can heal from the trauma. It doesn't ever go away, but they can heal from it so that it doesn't get suppressed, because when it is suppressed, it doesn't go away either. It simply goes into the next generation.
So that's really powerful. And it's my sense as a white woman that these conversations that are having, and the speaking out about the discrimination and the differential treatment by police of people of color is really a healthy thing. That's my sense of it. And it plays back to your sort of opening comments about having the conversations about these issues and not suppressing them. I have to share with you that there was several weeks ago a post by, and I'm not going to remember her name, there was an article in Salon, on Salon.com by an African-American young woman who was coming up to New York and was on a train, and she was about to do a teach-in around Ferguson. And she was on the train, had her earbuds in, listening to music, looking out the window. The train was a full train. She had an empty seat beside her, and she had her work bag sitting there with her laptop opened up, but just sitting in it. And she said, she was looking out the window, and she said, suddenly I see this white hand come in and grab my stuff and move my stuff. And she said, I turned around and saw this white man and said to him, don't touch my stuff. And he said, well, you need to listen to me when I talk to you. And she went on a riff that was so powerful about how a black man would never think of touching a white woman's bag and moving it. He would do whatever he had to get her attention. And indeed, while he might have spoken to this man might have spoken to this woman, he wasn't waving in front of her face, or he didn't tap her on the shoulder, what have you. And I posted this on Facebook, and with the message that I'd like my friends to read this to the very end, and not just to push like, but rather read it. And I will tell you that I had almost no white friends commenting on it, only my friends who were African American or Latina. I had almost no likes from my white friends on this. And I was shocked and appalled and disappointed. So I, from the standpoint of white privilege and trying to also have conversations about people who are not of color, trying to have a deeper understanding of what people of color face in this country and the subtleties and the nuances that we don't even have a clue about, I see these conversations as enormously important to all of us. And I'm hoping they'll continue.
I would just like to add, Diana, I'm so happy that you shared that story. There is something, too, that I'm learning after 23 years of teaching in a school of social work where the majority of my students are white. And that is that our students come to us with a sense of history that is really, really limited. So they don't know the history of the United States of America and the appalling things that have occurred in creating this great democracy in terms of African Americans and Native Americans and Japanese people and what we've done to various groups of people in this country. And the other thing that I notice is that oppression hurts everybody. And when I ask my white students how have they been harmed by oppression, they can't name it. And that's something that I would really challenge white people to work on, is to understand how oppression hurts white people too.
Well, powerful message. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
Yes.
So chronic stress undoubtedly plays a significant role in healthcare disparities, specifically high blood pressure. And before we wrap up, I want to also emphasize that we know hypertension kills. About 1,000 deaths per day are attributed to high blood pressure. It robs some of their eyesight. and it contributes to the alarmingly high rate of individuals who currently receive dialysis. High blood pressure is a health condition that affects 1 out of 3 Americans and disproportionately affects blacks. If you or someone you know has high blood pressure, consider how chronic stress could be impacting your ability to live a healthier life, and think about what Willie said about the actions that are needed to be taken to eliminate or manage chronic stress.
Well, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I just want to thank you, Dr. Kenya Beard, for producing this segment of Health Styles, and to Dr. Willie Tolliver for coming on Health Styles today. This was a fascinating discussion, and I thank you both very much. I'm Diana
Thank
Mason.
Thank you for the opportunity, Diana.
I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. You can follow us online at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. That's centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City.